Hi, I'm Susan Lewis. I sat down with Philadelphia Opera Collective founder and producer Michael Leinhard and composer Josh Hartman to talk about their most recent work, Jump the Moon. We talked about the mission of making opera accessible by performing in small spaces and doing operas in English. I asked Michael if choosing subjects about innovators was also part of the strategy.
Subjects that involve innovators and that matter to us. We tell stories that we feel need to be told. This year, we're focusing on two female scientists, Annie Jump Cannon and Antonia, who worked for Edward Charles Pickering in Harvard University, cataloging the stars. And they were largely pushed to the side because their points of view, which are still correct, their findings we still use today, largely weren't believed or held as fact simply because they're women. So we're trying to give people a voice. We're trying to tell a story that needs to be told, and we're doing it in a wholly accessible way.
How does the story make it more accessible to people?
Well, we are focusing on the drama and building the music around it. Much like opera was originally written when Mozart was writing opera or Puccini, Josh Hartman has written the opera for specific singers that we've been working with, some of them since our inception, who, when we are in a room and we're playing within the space, we all trust each other wholly, which is really quite lovely. When you come and see one of our operas, opera singers are looking you in the eye. They are truly engaging you. They're making sure that you are 100% within the story. Our operas, rather than being 3 hours long, usually are anywhere between 75 minutes and 100 minutes long, something that's much more digestible for a new opera goer. One thing that we do that no other opera company is doing that I'm aware of is, rather than just using opera singers, we have a unique collection of opera singers, actors, musical theater singers, as well as composers and other musicians helping build our stories. Our actors and our musical theater singers reach people on a visceral core level. It helps them relate to the human voice. And then the opera singers elevate the voice, which is really rather quite nice. It helps with that accessibility because people can see the show and say, oh, I can sort of sing like that guy. And then they hear someone like Kirsten Kunkel, who's singing Annie Jump Cannon, and it elevates them. And rather than just having an opera singer come out and singing, where there's that bit of a disconnect, we make sure we meet someone on their level and then raise them up.
Does music and singing a story tap into something deeper than just telling the story?
Oh, 100%. The human voice can do so many wonderful things. When you say something, you can evoke so many emotions, but you can't quite evoke all the emotions that you can when you're singing. Because when you're singing, you can tap into everything that the human voice can do, and it is the greatest instrument on the planet. I mean, let's just face it. We are approaching this opera extremely experimentally. Josh has written some music that really stretches our singers, is making some opera singers do things that they typically wouldn't do in an opera, and we're forcing the musical theater singers to do the same. And in that way, we are trying to use the whole instrument.
I was going to ask you, why is this called an experimental opera?
Well, I think that's a question that's better focused on Josh here.
Okay, Josh, let's back up for a minute, though, and talk to me about what's your background and how did you come to this?
I am a graduate student at Temple University in the music department, Boyer, and I bopped around Philadelphia enough to meet enough people that I got a random phone call one day, which was the most surreal and wonderful phone call ever last summer in the middle of my other job when I get Michael Leinhard calling me saying, so, I've heard good things about you from my other composer friend. We need an opera written. Could you do it in a month? And I said, sure, I will. And that's where I think the really interesting thing about Frankenstein that we did last year, that we had Reese Rivek write Act 1, and then I came in and wrote Act 2, which, considering the subject matter of the story being about all these different artists working together, was only that much more appropriate. And so we had such a lovely experience working together last year that we met some good South Street beer and talked about what we might want to do next year. And I was immediately taken in with this idea they had of Annie Jump Cannon, especially because having just gone through and watched Cosmos with Carl Sagan, you could, and also with Neil deGrasse Tyson, the new Cosmos, that focuses specifically on Annie Jump Cannon and the star counters of Pickering's harem, as they so colorfully called it. But being able to reach into that fascinating story, and I've already, as a composer, experimented a lot with celestial themes. I seem drawn to them to the end of the earth, and I suppose you could say beyond. So being able to write this fascinating story about not only important women scientists, but women scientists who also happened to be astronomers, who let me play with all of the musical ideas that I love of the heavens. You know, I've got Ligeti, Lux Aeterna screaming in my ear, which I will see how far I can get into that. They definitely don't like it when you ask them to sing Lux Aeterna. But it fits into my voice very well, and it's been a wonderful experience in the way that the opera collective works. And I think you asked, how is this an experimental opera? I think it's experimental both in the way that we present it to people, in that we are doing things on a smaller scale. The story does tend to happen at a faster pace, although, say, Jump the Moon is certainly at a slower pace than Frankenstein was, but we're allowing it to just suspend time when we need to suspend time, go into dream states when we need to go into dream states, and play around with that kind of storytelling that isn't confined to just, well, we're doing another adaptation of Shakespeare, which is wonderful, but it doesn't fit into this kind of story that you're trying to tell, and you don't have to follow the path perfectly. We're building a world for you to enter into, and I hope that the music reflects that in the textures that we're using, and it's experimental in the way of writing these wonderful textures in this music. Because working in such a rapid-fire way that we've been doing it this summer. Normally, you know, when you get an opera commission, they plan these things out years in advance. All this money gets thrown around, and you get these big orchestras and huge professional choruses to come in, and here we are working in these little rooms in the basements of churches, and over the course of a summer, coming up with the story and writing the scenes and being with the librettist every day at the rehearsals and being able to fine-tune the music to exactly what we need, where we need it. If we decide that we're singing a chord and, well, that it would just sound much better if she popped up to that high A and held it for the next four measures. We can do that. We can just make decisions like that artistically on the spot, which I think there's a visceral quality to the opera that will come through to the audience.
Both of you seem very enthusiastic about the story. Why is this an important story to tell?
Oh, I think it's an important story to tell because this is a really important thing that was done, and these women didn't really get their, I suppose you could say, their time in the sun, which is appropriate, their time in the star for a long time, just because of the latent sexism in the world, especially the academic world of Harvard in the early parts of the 20th century. And modern astronomy and astrophysics really wouldn't exist without Annie Jump Cannon, especially, I mean, the thing that she did was, as she was counting the stars, she got to be rapid fire quick at figuring out what category they were in, and she's the one who came up with the category that we still keep for the stars, which she kept with the mnemonic, Obia Fine Girl Kiss Me. And she noticed that all the different stars, she could read their spectra and read their magnitude and see exactly what they were. And it was later women, Cecilia Payne, who is not in the opera but is another several decades later, wonderful woman astronomer from Harvard, who noticed that what Annie had done was really organize stars by temperature. And when they did that, they realized, oh my God, they're not just rocks that are so hot they're glowing, they're all made of hydrogen and helium. And you can look at the color of them in their spectra and you can see how hot they are, even though they're millions of light years away. And without being able to recognize that we could study stars so closely from a distance like that and get these systems that were put in place, nothing that we know now would be even remotely possible of what we've learned about other galaxies and other universes. And it took a long time for Annie Jump Cannon to get her due, and I think it's also helpful to note that she was deaf. She lived her whole adult life in this world totally surrounded by her science, and deafness, I think, has that tendency to separate you a little bit from everyone around you. So not only are we dealing with important women who are astronomers that we could not have our modern science without, but we're also dealing with a disabled woman who we could not have anything today in terms of astronomy or astrophysics without.
So how, as a composer, do you decide what sounds you want to create when you're dealing with this kind of a subject?
I try to look at celestial music in a way that is beautiful but also objective. I think it's very easy to make things very pretty, but I don't think that always tells the whole story. So there's definitely beautiful music at every opportunity that I could. But I like to think that it's beautiful music with just that little bit of an edge, because I think that's what really reflects what's so beautiful about the universe, is that when you are standing in awe of how huge these galaxies are and how beautiful these nebula can swirl around each other, and they blot out the light from behind them with their dust clouds, and then gravitational lensing, watching a galaxy be twisted and pulled into three different images as it goes around big gravity wells. It is beautiful, but it's not roses and petals beautiful. It's beautiful that also has this power behind it. And I think I was definitely very inspired by the composers who have come before me and have been working in these things. I'm specifically like Ligeti's Lux Aeterna, which is a brutally hard thing to sing in a cappella music, but when you really pull it off, I think there is this universal truth hiding in there, that these, if you take any vertical slice of it, it's all just serene. It's out of this world beautiful. Even if it's technically atonal, it holds itself long enough that it doesn't matter what notes you use. The texture alone gives it its beauty. There's also Jupp Franson's Harmony of the Spheres, which is gorgeous, like hour and a half long, almost choral symphony, you could call it. These long-held textures, and it even goes back to the times of the Renaissance when we're talking about the harmony of the spheres, when we believed that everything was circles and spheres that kept rotating around each other and you could move between different layers of them. Choral music and the universe have always been very intimately connected from as long as we've had choral music as we would understand it today.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.